Good evening, Martin. Welcome to the Space Show.
Thank you, Andrew. It's a pleasure to be on the show with you.
Most people have heard of radar, but what about LIDAR or LIDAR?
Well, LIDAR is very equivalent, actually. Instead of firing little pulses of radio waves, you fire little pulses of light waves. And effectively, you get the same bounce back from various constituents of the atmosphere, such as clouds and dust. The advantage of light is that you can see smaller particles, so that you can see the dust in the atmosphere, and you can see small cloud drops. Mainly with radar, you're restricted to seeing the large water drops in raining clouds.
So in radar, you send out a beam, and you get a reflection back from some object. And in this case, you're sending out just simply light or photons and getting the reflection back.
Right, and the secret is you have a very short pulse. In actuality, it's only about 3 meters long, so that you get this little broomstick sent out. And, of course, as it's so short, you can obtain the range very accurately by timing the time that it takes to bounce off some constituent of the atmosphere and return to a receiver. So in that sense, it's very equivalent to radar.
Now, what sort of light are you using? The L stands for, is it light or something else?
No, it really is light. In fact, you can use any wavelength through the visible or the infrared spectrum to with different LIDARs. The one we particularly use is 0.53 microns, which means it's in the green part of the spectrum, so it's green light. And in fact, when you fire the laser at night, you can see a very intense green beam. So we have to take a little bit. We'll have to be a little bit careful about aircraft going in the vicinity because the beam is pretty intense. But it's only dangerous if you look straight down the beam. Otherwise, it's quite safe.
Why do you use a laser rather than just an ordinary searchlight?
Well, the laser has the property of a very high energy and very well focused or very well collimated light, so that it goes out and spreads out only very slowly. For instance, after, say, travelling for 10 kilometres, the spot size is only, say, 50 metres. So in that way, we can get enough light out to get enough signal back. The scattering from dust and clouds, as you'd appreciate, fairly weak, and it's scattered out in all directions. We only get a little bit back from the receiver, so it's necessary to have a very intense beam to start with.
So, Martin, what do you use a LIDAR for?
Well, you can use it for a number of applications. Our particular interest is, as I've said before, looking at clouds and dust. But you can use it. There are very specialized applications now. You can profile water vapor or ozone in the atmosphere. You need special wavelengths for this. So now it's starting to have a wide range of applications in atmospheric science. It's easiest to sound clouds and dust because you get a large reflection from them. So in a sense, we've got the easiest targets. But it's a very fruitful area.
And this is being done right here in Australia?
Yes, we've actually been firing lasers from Aspendale for about 20 years. And we've probably got the edge on other groups around the world in our analysis and interpretation of cloud returns. We've looked at many different clouds. We're looking at their climatic impact, and which they're very important in climate, I might say. And so we feel that we've done a vast amount of work in this area, which is of importance to climate change. And I guess this is the reason why I was asked to sit on the science team of LIGHT.
LIGHT being?
LIGHT being the LIDAR in Space Technology Experiment, Andrew.
So instead of firing it from the ground up, you've sort of turned the thing upside down and firing it from space down towards the ground.
Right, that's the idea. And in that way, we can get a global picture of clouds and dust instead of just a local picture. And of course, this is very important to see regional effects.
And is that the only advantage, the fact that because the shuttle moves, that you do get a worldwide perspective, whereas from the ground you're obviously situated in one spot? Are there any other advantages to doing it from space?
Well, one of the advantages is a lot of the thin, important clouds in climate are the high clouds, the ice clouds. And sometimes from the ground, or quite frequently from the ground, you get heavy cloud in between, which you can't view through with the LIDAR. You can't see the clouds through it, so you can't see through it with LIDAR. Whereas from space, the first things that you encounter are these high, thin clouds. Similarly, we can get good measurements on the stratospheric aerosol. Several years ago, Mount Pinatubo went off. There was a big dust veil was diffused around the world, and we've been studying this from the ground. From space, we got marvelous profiles of Pinatubo in the stratosphere because it was the first layers that we encountered. So in that sense, top-down has advantages.
Mm. Now, was it just simply a case of packaging up your ground-based apparatus and hauling it aboard across the United States and shoving it on the shuttle and away you go, or were there some design difficulties on the way?
Not quite, Andrew. Actually, the instrument, I might say, was built and designed and built by NASA Langley Research Center in Hampton, Virginia. And the project leader was Dr. Pat McCormick, who's an eminent scientist in the field. And he got together a science team on which I was very privileged to be on. And we sort of really designed the experiments which drove how they were going to design the LIDAR, if you like. So we put in input saying we wanted to do this, that, and the other. And then the engineers in NASA built the instrument, designed it, built it, and did everything that had to be done, which was quite a lot. Mm. And they did use some new techniques. There's some new, what we call a flash lamp, which actually excites the laser rod, which gives you this high energy. The flash lamp needs a lot of power, and we had to devise, or NASA had to devise, a new way of doing this. This is a modern way, which other people are starting to use as well. But in fact, NASA used this method of using laser diodes to excite the rod, which is far more efficient, and therefore they could use much lower power supplies on the shuttle, which allowed us to fly it on the shuttle. In fact, we have a huge power supply on our ground based one here, which takes say 14 kilowatts, and I don't think there would have been much left over for the astronauts in that case.
Yes, I'm not too sure what the exact power generation capacity of the shuttle is, but it's certainly not 14 kilowatts.
Well, that's right. I can't give you an exact figure, but I know we could only operate as it was for 4 hours a day.
Mm. Well, obviously this didn't happen overnight. How long did it actually take to develop the payload?
Well, I think I was asked to sit on the science team back in 1987, and I've been attending meetings just about every year since then over in the States. And so it's taken something like 7 years to develop the payload, to get everything built to specs. They actually managed to find a telescope from another application. They spent a long time making sure that this telescope wasn't going to defocus like another one that we know about. And so there was a lot of effort put in at NASA Langley. I can't remember how many. They had something like 80 engineers working on it, I think, at one time. That's the sort of scale of the operation. We were very privileged to see it in the clean room there several times, and watching its development through the years.
What were the objectives of your experiment then?
Well, there were two main objectives. Of course, the first objective was to demonstrate that we could run a LIDAR in space. That was a very important objective because it hadn't been done before. It's a large power requirement. It's a sophisticated apparatus. It all had to be pressurized and cooled. It was cooled by using particular gases, of which I can't remember the name, but the whole... So that in that sense, it was a complex piece of apparatus.
Mm. And the scientific objectives?
The scientific objectives, well, of course, the technology demonstration was necessary because the thing was mooted in the time in which all applications in NASA had to have a commercial or technological application. And so this is why it was able to fly at that time. But we also put a lot of science into it, and the main science aims were first to get a 3D picture of clouds around the globe, similarly to get a 3D picture of what we call aerosols or haze, dust, and this includes desert dust, pollution, a lot of pollution. There's vast areas, for instance, in Africa where they burn every year, and there's large amounts of biomass burning material which can be viewed. There's areas, of course, of industrial pollution. And we can also see important aspects of the atmosphere, like the boundary layer, where all the activity occurs close to the Earth, and that's capped by an inversion. And we can see that because that's where the dust stops and it's clear air above. So we also had, that was another objective, was to look at the global structure of the boundary layer. And as I said before, we're also looking at volcanic clouds.
Now, you mentioned looking at clouds, ordinary water clouds, in three dimensions. What's the point of doing that?
Well, the point of doing that, Andrew, is that clouds have very subtle effects. A high cloud acts almost like another greenhouse absorber, and it reflects a little bit of radiation, but it also absorbs a lot of heat radiation from the surface and emits it to space at a lower temperature, therefore at a lower amount. So it's another greenhouse agent. Lower clouds reflect a vast amount of light out, solar radiation out, as we know, on a cloudy day it's cool, but they have a temperature which is closer to surface temperature, so that they don't have such a greenhouse effect. So there's some very subtle effects as to where the clouds are placed in the atmosphere, how cold they are, how warm they are. Therefore, it's very important to know the three-dimensional distribution of clouds. Not only that, we can also get information on what we call their optical properties, their optical depth, which tell us exactly how much solar radiation will be reflected out, how much heat radiation from the surface will be reabsorbed. So this is actually one of the largest uncertainties in climate modelling now, is the clouds, because they're so very difficult to investigate from the ground, and aircraft are expensive. So to have a shuttle where we can look at these marvellous profiles around the Earth was an absolute luxury.
Well, Martin, we'll come back to you after a message from the station here. Well, Martin, your experiment on the space shuttle appears to have worked. Have you had any results come through yet?
Well, Andrew, it was very exciting. I mean, it worked marvellously. I was actually at the launch at Kennedy Space Center in Florida, and that was a terrific experience. Marvellous, actually, to see the shuttle thunder off into space. It was 2 hours late, but what's 2 hours amongst friends when we got it off that day? And then we went back to Houston to the data take, and we spent 9 days there taking data at odd times of the day and night. We had about four hours every day, and so many orbits during that time, say six orbits. And during that time, we actually had real-time data coming back, low-resolution data to resolution. When I say a resolution, that's the horizontal bite that we got of about 70 kilometers. There was also high data resolution at 7 kilometers and 700 meters. So we were able to see the results coming out as the shuttle went over. As we went over the tropics, we could see the high clouds coming up. Then we would see clear pieces, particularly over Australia. And then we'd get to the high latitudes with much middle-level and high-level cloud. So in a sense, we were getting data all the time, and so that we could monitor the quality of the data. I might say the quality of the data was very good. It was way past our expectations, at least mine, and we got some stunning results.
One of the aims you mentioned was to measure volcanic dust. Did any volcanoes oblige?
Well, two volcanoes did actually erupt. They obliged in that way. I think it was Kamchatka. We might have got some of that. I'm not absolutely sure. I wasn't on that particular orbit. And then we knew a ball had gone off. I quickly contacted a colleague of mine back here, Dr. Prater. He contacted the volcano people to find out more about its characteristics. And we relayed that back to Houston. And we had an orbit very close to Rabaul, you know, but as luck would have it, we went the wrong side of the wind. The wind was blowing one way and we went the other, so we did miss that one. However, we did go over a cyclone.
Oh, right. And I believe the shuttle, you mentioned the shuttle did come over Australia.
Yes.
What about Melbourne?
Yes.
And therefore some comparisons perhaps with the work that you've been doing here in Aspendale.
Yes, indeed. We had one orbit right over Melbourne, and I might say, Andrew, that there was a large validation program of about 50 scientists around the world, some of them with LIDARs on the ground, others flying off the coast of America, South America and Africa. We had our own LIDAR firing here, and my colleague, Dr. Young, and his colleagues very obligingly got up at 4 in the morning to get our perspective from here as light went over, and in fact within a day we could see that we got very good correspondence.
Were they doing checks as well in other parts of the world?
Yes, they were indeed. There was a LIDAR even in Siberia, several in Europe, several in the USA. There was one in New Zealand, the Italian group from outside Florence, I believe, we're making measurements at a station in New Zealand. So we did get some Southern Hemisphere coverage. But it's interesting you talk about Australia, Andrew, in another context, that every time we went over Australia, all the science team said, blimey, it looks so clear. It was the clearest atmosphere that we went over anywhere in the world, despite the drought.
Mm. So not a great deal of dust in the air over Australia?
No, not comparatively. There were a few dust layers, which I would have expected, you know, with a severe drought, but nothing compared to what we saw in the Middle East or off the west coast of South America.
Mm. Was this, do you think, a seasonal effect, or is it just the nature of our Southern Hemisphere?
Well, no, I think it's the nature of our Southern Hemisphere. The dust might come up a bit in summer, I guess, with the higher winds, but then it's raining also a bit in summer in some parts of the country. So I'm not sure, and this is another reason why we'd like to have a LIDAR up there for a longer time, is that we could look at these seasonal effects.
Mm. Now, of course, you've got such a vast amount of data back, it must take a long, long time to analyse. Have you done any analysis yet, and how long do you think it will take?
Yes, it will take a long time, Andrew. Well, one thing we were lucky with was that we had a couple of data processors who were very committed and worked even 24-hour shifts and produced for us beautiful colour plots. And I have a complete section from Japan right down over Australia of the atmosphere in the two dimensions. And so that in that sense, we have got some data to look at. The actual numbers, we have just managed to get the quick look data over in the store here on the archive here in Aspendale, so that we can start working on that soon.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and any plans for flying the same experiment again or for flying other experiments?
Well, Andrew, yes, we were going to have another flight in a year or so, Light 2, but I believe that with the space station having been approved by Congress, that a lot of these shuttle flights are going to be dedicated to building the space station, and we may miss out. On the other hand, I know NASA now are looking at a free-flying LIDAR in space, that is one that stays up there automatically with no manual operation, say for 2 years, just like the other images which give us our weather photos. So we hope that that comes to pass.
Because that would be quite an advantage, because the shuttle only goes up for a week, 2 weeks at the most. Mm. And obviously, for many of these things, you need to observe them over a period of time, don't you?
Well, you do, although some of my colleagues said, gosh, you're lucky, you know, you've only got 10 days' data. We've got 2 years, and my goodness. It's going to take us years to just to analyse those 10 days. But it's true, in a sense, that once we've got our operational systems in place and our analysis systems in place for just extracting weather information, then it will be marvellous to have a LIDAR up there, because not only will the Weather Bureau, for instance, here be able to see the image of a cloud, but it'll know exactly what height it is, what density. And I think that's going to be a tremendous advantage. I think it's a quantum leap, really.
So you're looking forward to being actively involved in all that?
Well, yes, I hope so.
Okay, now, you work here in Aspendale, not very far from the studios of Southern FM. How did you get into this sort of business? What's your background in
science?
Well,
I guess my background is physics, Andrew. I've always had an interest in clouds, and I started off doing some work in East Africa, actually, and teaching there physics at a college. Then I went back to London and I took my PhD in solid-state physics. But that was also spectroscopic work, so I was using the sorts of detectors that I've been using ever since, and I got a feel for spectroscopy and radiation and so on there. Having got a PhD at Queen Mary College in physics, I came out to Aspendale, and I've been here, I guess, for 24 years or so, working in problems of radiation transfer through the atmosphere. It's great fun.
Mm. Well, Martin, I hope that all goes well with the future plans on the experiment that you've got, and that the data does work out as you expect. And I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight on the Space Show.
Thank you, Andrew. It's been a pleasure, and yes, indeed, the data looks very exciting, and I hope that we can make something of it, not only for Australia, but for the global community and for climate change work.